Grey Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Grey Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. It is Friday, August 27, 2004, 10:04 a.m. on the central coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name's Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we are addressing the need for antivirus software and spyware and adware removal tools. During the second half of the show, I welcome you to join our conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Or you can go to geekspeak.org, click on The Geeks, then click on Send a Message. We'll be answering any calls and questions about technology in the second half of the show. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air and with me are geeks: Sean Cleveland, Technical Marketing Communications Manager for Transmeta; John Tracy, owner and operator of FeltonGames.com; and Miles Elam, programmer and student of American literature. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Lyle.
Before we get into our discussion about cleaning up your machine, getting rid of viruses and adware, and protecting it in general, which we'll be addressing in just a few minutes, let's do some news. Sean, I'd like to start with you, sir.
Yeah, TFT LCD panels are in big supply right now. Funny, because they were in such short supply, high demand earlier this year. Now there's an oversupply of these. This means lower prices.
For LCDs in general or just for TFT?
For LCDs in general.
Great.
They expect prices to fall sequentially in September. A little less dramatically this month, but definitely September, possibly, you know, after that as well. They expect 19-inch LCD monitor panels to fall below $300.
Wow.
17-inch LCD monitor panels to drop below $200.
Wait, 19-inch below $300?
Yes. And they expect 15-inch panels to drop somewhere between $160 and $170.
What about LCD TVs?
Yeah. Well, 20-inch LCD TV panels will remain pretty much at about $360, and larger 30 to 32-inch LCD TV panels, they expect will fall maybe $20 or $30 down to the $900, $950 range.
That's good. That's, you know, they're around $1,200 right now.
Yeah.
So that's not bad.
And I would expect that there probably will still be a premium for 20, 21-inch and bigger computer LCD monitors.
Still, a 19-inch LCD monitor is a pretty nice thing. I mean, it is. It uses a lot less energy. It's got less of that whole radiation thing that people have been complaining
about.
You get
way more desk space.
You get way more desk space. You don't break your back trying to move it around.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you're doing LAN parties, it is so nice to just pick up a 19-inch LCD monitor to instead of a 21-inch.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's just easier on your eyes.
It is a little easier on your eyes.
And it's a lot easier. Because I've been doing dual monitor at work, just for fun.
I
got a 21-inch next to a 19-inch flat panel, 21-inch monitor, regular CRT monitor in. And, wow, when I look between the two, it's a big difference.
It's magical.
Looking at a flat panel monitor, your eyes just relax because it's, I think, something to do with the refresh rate. They're not straining.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I always thought that LCD monitors were not as good as CRTs when it comes to eye strain, but I guess I'm incorrect. It does make sense that it's a more stable image.
Yeah.
Because the picture's not being redrawn so many times per second.
And then, of course, there's the whole issue of CRTs, or traditional television-type monitors, have a lot of lead in them.
They do. And the picture's not square on a CRT. I mean, you can get they don't make them completely flat. And because of the CRT technology, it's really hard to get the corners to be as sharp as the middle.
It really has
and your eyes detect all this.
Right.
The flat panel's not a problem. It's the same image all the way.
Good. Cheap across. Flat panels, LCDs, same thing coming our way. Great. Thank you very much. John, I'll go to you.
So what should you do with these cheap flat panel displays? Apparently, according to the latest trend in gaming, you should be playing video games on them because video gaming has finally overtaken PC gaming. Originally, long ago, back in the 70s, 80s, you had the Atari 2600 and Activision and all those gaming consoles. Then the PCs became the game machine because you could upgrade a PC in order to play the latest games.
Mm-hmm.
So for a long time, PC gaming has dominated the video gaming market. Recently, at the annual Gaming in America survey published by Ziff Davis Media's Game Group, they found that 4.5 million households play video games and only, 54.5 million households versus 52.3 million Americans that play games on PCs.
So basically we're talking about console games like the Xbox and the PlayStation, things like that.
Exactly.
They've overtaken the PC gaming market in the respective survey that was taking place.
They also
and
say
it makes sense. I mean, you can get one of these boxes for under $300 that plays video games on your television. Most people have televisions.
Well, on the contrary, I was thinking most people have PCs. And so
yeah,
it's
but the high-end games.
Yeah, at the same time, I think that's more of a push from developers rather than...
What game market? I mean, what... The age player that's playing these, you know, 26% of the market that they're targeting is, you know, students, high school students, junior high school students,
right.
Early college students, people who maybe their parents have a PC they use or they have the hand-me-down PC they use, but they really want to be able to play, you know, better games than that. So it's a cheaper way to get into gaming.
That's the thing. When all of us get together and we bring our machines together and we actually play games, there's a lot of setup and hookup and making sure the machine works. PlayStations and Xboxes and stuff, you get them, you plug them in,
right.
And they work right away.
No parent wants to spend that much time setting up a gaming system for their kid all
never
the time.
Never underestimate the power of a child who wants to play a computer game.
Not every child is a geek, though, but two.
Right. But, that's how I became a geek, was playing computer games, quite honestly. But in addition to that, what you get from the Xbox and the PlayStation 2, for example, is a non-moving target. That's what I was saying developers, I think, are the big push behind them, is the fact that they go, oh, they have an Xbox.
Yeah.
This is how the game is going to perform.
Well, games are being released on both the console and the PC platforms more and more. Look at Doom 3, big PC game. Would have never been released on a platform before. It's being released on Xbox. You know, so that's really driving demand, I think. And the other thing I think that leads to this overtaking PC gaming is the fact the competition is just so intense that the prices have really dropped. You know, to get an Xbox now is $150.
Wow.
You know, and it comes with a game. You know, it's and PlayStation 2 is very competitive, so they're very compelling for parents who don't want to put out a lot of money for a high-end PC gaming platform.
We have four computers in our house and two kids, and we are now thinking, gosh, you know, maybe we should get a gaming console because there's a lot of things there that we, you know, it'd be nice to free up one of the computers sometimes because the kids, and we have one computer per person.
You have one computer per person. Why do you need to free up one?
Because some of our computers are
getting a little
longer.
Oh, you mean free up the
PC? John, I call that you're a geek.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go on to our next geek. Miles, news story, sir.
Yes, and a story that all the fans of Star Trek would be proud, especially the ones of the fourth Star Trek movie.
Which was the best one.
I disagree.
Okay,
Wrath of Khan, but that's getting off the
topic. Yeah, Wrath of Khan, what?
But
the movie that broke all others. He never meets his adversary. It's great. Go ahead, Mom.
There's some researchers who have come up with transparent aluminum.
Really?
Really. Anatoly Rosenplant and colleagues at 3M in Minnesota used
reference. I'm like, what are you talking? Okay, so go on.
Flame spray technique to alloy alumina or aluminum oxide. Actually, this comes from a British publication, so it's aluminium oxide.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't. The samples that I see on the website are rather small. They look like lenses that are in the inch diameter range. However, they can be tinted. They've played around with different materials, different...
Okay, is aluminum, is it conductive?
You know, I don't know whether it's conductive. However, it's basically a glass. It's glass is formed when a molten material is cooled so quickly that its constituent atoms don't have time to align themselves into an ordered lattice. The thing is, with a silica base, like that you make standard glass, The difference between the molten state and the solid state is to get it to that transition point to cool it off isn't very difficult, doesn't require as much energy.
Mm-hmm.
But something like aluminum, you require you know, 1,000 degrees per second of a transfer to get it to fix. So this is a big step in metallurgy.
Wow, very cool. Thank you, Miles. Miles, I'd like you to just, you know, that whole English literature thing, just drop that. Go back to school and learn this, because this is cool. Thank you, Miles. Sean, a news story from you, sir?
Yeah, this is kind of cool. Sony has launched a 16X DVD burner.
How fast is it? How quickly does it burn a DVD?
6 minutes. 4.7 gigs in, yeah, six minutes. This is for the Plus R specification. Their new drive will, it's new 710 model, will burn dash R, but only at 8X.
Hmm.
The Plus R standard was delivered last June at 16X, and Sony's the first to do this.
Oh, I see. So the dash R people don't have a spec on 16.
They must not have yet, okay. Or it's not ready.
But this drive does.
Sony has always pushed Plus R, so I can see why they might put a drive out
right
before that was ready.
Right.
So this, though, reaches, they think this pretty much reaches the physical limit of DVD recording. They don't expect to be able to increase the speed past this.
What's your first reaction when you hear someone in technology say, yeah, this is the maximum the technology will allow? I normally go, nah, they'll fix it. The one that really caught me was when they moved from 28.8 modems, which was the theoretical maximum data you could put through that kind of line,
yeah,
to 56.
Oh, well, let me finish here. A 16X disc spins at about 10,000 RPM.
Okay, 10,000 revolutions per minute.
Yeah, which is considered to be the highest possible limit of polycarbonate material that makes up a DVD disc.
So they're saying if they make a faster disc, it'll tear the disc apart.
That's what they say.
Right.
According to industry sources, faster speeds may crack a DVD.
Uh-huh. And you know what? I could swear I heard this when 4-speed CD-ROM drives were out.
Yeah.
And, oh, they made 8-speed and we're like, we can't go much faster. Like, we're approaching that.
Maybe they'll just start making the discs out of transparent aluminum. Then it can spin faster.
Or, a very common thing that I've seen, or something that I saw maybe 7 years ago when I bought a CD-ROM drive that was a 50-speed. We're like, how did you get 50-speed? You put multiple lasers into the mechanism and read faster. Surprise.
Imagine that.
So, I mean, if they use exactly the same
technology,
they're going to run into a hole.
Maybe they can't spin the disc faster, but possibly they can come up with new materials.
Maybe they'll just start spinning the machine around the disc.
That would be cool.
Yeah, I do have to wonder with the story, though. Like, how many calls or how many emails are we going to get from people saying, you said plus R minus R A B 7 9.
Wait. What's plus R W versus? I'm sorry, plus R and dash R with respect to DVDs?
No, they're two very. They're competing standards. They were competing standards until the DVD standards group welcomed both of them in, and now drive makers are producing drives with both. So the bonus is you get both. The difference is plus R is good for data. Dash R is good for video, and Dash R is a little more compatible with older DVD players.
Because the technology was out there first.
Yeah, when I say DVD players, I mean the kind that you buy for your television set. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to burn a movie, like a home movie or something, to DVD, you may want to try. You might be able to do plus R. You'd have to check your book, your specs, and your DVD player. Most likely, you could do Dash R, no problem.
Yeah, but when you're making a DVD, you don't necessarily just want to play it on your own DVD player.
You
want to
play
it
on others. So
yeah.
Dash R is going to give you a little more compatibility.
Right.
But Plus R, it really is better for data.
Okay. Let's go on to more news. What's going on in space, John? Like the Mars... Are you not ready for that? Okay.
No, Miles actually has the space story today.
Oh, really?
Switch.
Whoa, okay.
Yeah, we got you on that one.
Pull the rug out from underneath me, Miles, Mr. Spaceman.
Yeah, the Mars Odyssey basically has finished all of its prime mission objectives. It's discovered vast supplies of frozen water on Mars, ran safety checks for future astronauts, simulations for how astronauts would survive in around Mars, mapped surface textures and minerals all over Mars, among many other scientific endeavors on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still there. It's still in orbit. It's still, you know,
still chugging away.
So a new mission plan has been made by NASA to run until 2006.
What's it going to do?
Well, we'll soon find out.
Cool. Great. Thank you very much, Miles. Well, now, John, what do you want to talk about, sir?
I want to start getting us into the virus stuff.
All right. Let's start doing the virus thing. This is the show.
New,
Oh, Miles, Sean has
my last email. It's supposed to move us into this.
Oh, well, gosh. Well, who do we pick?
John, it's spam. Are we talking about spam, too?
Well, I've got lots of stuff.
No. John, go ahead.
Go ahead, John.
See, now you've thrown me off. I've lost it. Okay, there's a new worm.
There's a new worm that's been discovered in the wild,
which means it's just been discovered. It's just like yesterday's worm. Mm-hmm. It's called Rbot-GR. There's a lot of Rbot viruses out there. This one in particular has a new twist. It installs a Trojan horse, which we will discuss later in the show, on an infected machine, and it allows hackers to get into your webcam, which is kind of interesting. So they big deal. So what? They say it's potentially being used to do industrial espionage for people who get webcams in sensitive areas, who do teleconferencing, things like that. And it also does the standard stuff. It can allow you to look at the contents of the hard drive, steal passwords with the keylogger, and launch DOS attacks. So it's a multi-purpose worm.
Update your virus definitions. Important
thing. There have been previous viruses that have the ability to look at a webcam.
Right.
But this is the first one that anyone's aware of that does it by default. That's part of the worm.
That's specifically what the payload or the Trojan horse allows it to do, yeah, mm-hmm. is to gather webcam footage. So if you have a webcam when you're not using it, just turn it off. And then
most of them don't have switches, so unplug a USB.
Yeah, that's true. And most of them also don't have active lights to let you know when it's being used, so it's really hard to tell when a webcam is in use.
Right.
So, you know, as always, update your antivirus, and you're okay.
All right, Sean, we'll go to you now, sir.
Yeah, and or buy a Mac.
Sorry.
Did I say that? Oh.
Sean.
Yes, Claire Swift, a research company who tracks spam, has said there has been a 350% jump in porn emails since June.
350%?
350%.
Wow.
There are new technologies being developed to combat this type of thing. IBM is applying ideas that it developed for sequencing DNA molecules to the detection of spam.
Weird.
So what they've taken, misspelled words, gobbledygook, and other types of information from spam messages, and they're looking at this in a different way. So what they're looking for are recurring patterns in DNA sequences, taking that information and applying it to recurring information in junk mail. And what they've come up with is a program called Chung Kuei, which is named after the Feng Shui talisman that protects homeowners against evil spirits. They fed a series of legitimate messages through a program in order to eliminate repeated patterns of messages that were common between both spam and ham. Ham is what they call legitimate messages. Mm-hmm. And what they found was, and this is a report in New Scientist, that 97% of spam messages were detected, and a far fewer rate of false positives were detected than conventional techniques, less than 1 in 1,000. So their new program is called Spam Guru.
And is it available?
It's being used in Lotus Workplace 2.0, and they're developing it for enterprise class.
Okay, so they're not going to...
But, you know, this is how, you know how it always works. That technology eventually moves down into the consumer space. Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you very much for that. Our topic for today does have to do with spam and adware and basically making your life a little easier. Last week, I was listening to last week's show again, and we just talked about, you know, someone called up again with a... How do I get my machine clean? What tools do I use? So we got together mostly yesterday, went ahead and tried to find some good applications and good resources for everyone that has a Windows machine that wants to be a little safer. For Macintosh people, you're fine. Don't worry about it. So,
but we do have a few tips that will help you.
Yeah, and in fact, one thing that everyone has to pay attention to is a thing called phishing. And John, would you address that first?
Phishing is it's a new term. It's phishing, and it's receiving an email that looks like it's from a legitimate business, usually a financial institution or eBay, PayPal. Sometimes you get them from them. It looks like it's a legitimate email. It has a link embedded into it. You click the link. It takes you to a site that looks like a real site from that financial institution or company, and asks you to put in some sensitive information, such as date of birth, password, passwords, username, social security number, all the things that identity thieves are trying to get. And in fact, that's exactly what it is. It's just a big filter that allows them to filter out information they need from you.
Hold that thought for just a second. If you're interested in following along with us, go to geekspeak.org, click on today's show, which is the 27th of August, and we have a list of ways to get your computer safer. So again, geekspeak.org. geekspeak.org if you want to follow along and do this with us. But what we're talking about right now with phishing is not on that page, and we don't talk about that because that's a state of mind that you have to get involved in, and that is about being very careful.
Which is what a lot of home security, home computer security is realizing that since there's so many other ways to protect a computer, a lot of times the personal attack is the easiest way. It's called social engineering, mm-hmm. Getting the person to reveal information that they wouldn't normally reveal by pretending you're someone in authority.
Right.
Such as the Citibank emails that we've
exactly.
talked about in the past.
Yeah, that's an exact.
Let's address that Citibank thing again. Let's address that Citibank thing again. Miles, what have you seen in a Citibank email?
Well, it basically says, we're sending you this email as a Citibank customer. They will have Citibank what looks like Citibank letterhead, the graphics from the site, and say, we're doing a database update. We need you to authenticate your user information or else we're going to have to disable the account. Encourages people to click on a link, and it takes them to a web page that looks conspicuously like a Citibank website.
Now, this Citibank one that was sent out, I got a copy of this too. I'm not a Citibank person. That's why it really flags, because I don't happen to have that account. But most of the time, these kind of phishing things have like spelling errors and grammatical errors. This one seemed to be pretty clean. Mm-hmm. Didn't have like mistakes. It seemed like it was someone speaking from Citibank.
Was it addressed to you?
Mine was addressed to me with my full name.
That's new, because normally one of the indications that it's a phishing email is it'll say dear user.
Right. Well, my user account happens to be my name. I mean, my email address is all @lyle@something. So, yeah.
So
it looks like me.
Do.
But this one actually had my last name in it too, and I don't know where they got that data, but they did get it.
Some things to look for. Normally, I would say is it's not addressed to you specifically, but that one was.
That's good. Spelling errors and grammatical errors.
Spelling errors, grammatical errors. If there's a phrase that seems odd in there, a lot of times you can do a Google search on that phrase and it'll reveal it's a hoax. But the most important thing, if anyone sends you an email asking for sensitive information that you're not expecting, it's a scam.
It's equivalent to someone calling and saying, hi, we're from your bank and we want to know your
right.
checking account number.
The same as when you receive an email with an important download from Microsoft. Please install this right
now. No one ever sends uploads
online. Yeah, no company will send you stuff to install. They may send you a link to a website.
But then be sure that that's actually the right website.
Right.
So from tricks on, like, that since that email that looked relatively legit sent a link that sent you to a site that looked like Citibank, Miles, how do you determine that that wasn't a Citibank website?
Well, I, like you, do not have a Citibank account. But I've also seen so many things that are like this that I was skeptical. That's the most important thing to find out if something is false, is simply be skeptical. I looked at the URL bar where you put in, you know, http://www.whatever.com. If you look up on there, and if it doesn't say Citibank.com, for example, at the very beginning, then...
Before any slashes.
Yeah, before...
Well, before the...
Well, after the HTTP,
/,
before anything else, then there's something wrong there.
Okay. So that's about protecting yourself from the attacks of social engineering type, where somebody's just trying to get you to do something stupid. But your computer can do something stupid, too. And most of the time, the way that works is there's a bug in the computer operating system, or in the email client you're using, or the browser. And that bug allows someone maliciously to run something on your machine. This is something where you don't actually have to be fooled. Your machine is being fooled. And the way you can protect, because you can't teach your machine to be skeptical unfortunately, the way you do that is a whole process of steps that we recommend. And there's 5 steps, basically. And if you go to geekspeak.org and click on today's show, Combating Adware, Spyware, and Internet Scams, we list the 5. And the first one is to upgrade your Windows operating system. Sean, how do you upgrade a Windows operating system? To get the most recent patches and such.
If you're Windows XP, just go to your Start menu, go to Programs, and you should see at the very top Update Windows.
Okay.
And that is a good way to go. Or you can just click on your Internet Explorer web browser and go to Windows Update.microsoft.com.
And that link is on the GeekSpeak show page. So when you go there, if you're using Internet Explorer or if you've done the Update Windows, it opens Internet Explorer actually for you. What is Internet Explorer and Microsoft doing to determine what you need? And how does it figure this out?
Well, in a non-invasive way, supposedly, without getting personal information. They actually see what you have installed in your machine. Basically,
what
the versions of files, and based upon that, they recommend updates.
Is that done via the registry, maybe? They scan the registry to see what's there?
Not sure how that works, actually. I know it's an ActiveX application. When you go there, it's going to ask you, do you want Microsoft to be able to run something? And you go ahead and say yes.
Which is why you need to run Internet Explorer, because that's what differentiates browsers like Mozilla and Thunderbird, or Firefox, excuse me. Right. Thunderbird's the email client. Firefox is the web client. Those do not have ActiveX. And it's ActiveX that makes your machine more vulnerable in a lot of cases.
And oddly enough, Microsoft, of course, is using this so that it's easier for them to run applications on machine light. And the best example, probably the widest use of ActiveX exists is this Microsoft Update tool that allows you to make your machine more secure.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest vulnerabilities in Windows currently is this ActiveX thing, where you go to a website and it says, something's been found on your machine, click this button to go on. And really, that button installs something on your machine.
It often installs a new version of the installer.
Yeah.
Of the ActiveX installer. It's pretty funny. So you wonder, why is that happening?
So there's some dangerous things in using Internet Explorer in general, and that's one of the later on tips that we're going to recommend, getting rid of Internet Explorer as your default browser. But you do need Internet Explorer to update Windows. Now, these updates, especially like Service Pack 2, which is now being updated when you go to windowsupdatemicrosoft.com, isn't it a little large for like a 28 modem?
Yeah, it's like 260 megabytes. Microsoft, in fact, this week has made it available on CD-ROM, so you can go up to their website and order it. Have it delivered to you.
And that'll have the most recent patches and such on there.
Every service pack incorporates every previous update, including the service packs before.
So do you happen to know how much the CD is? It's like probably under $10 kind of thing?
Let me go look.
Okay.
I was curious about
that
too.
If you're in a stuck level environment, there's a couple ways to do this. You get your machine to an environment that has a fast connection and then download the patches on it. Or you can just, turn on your machine and try to upload it while you're sleeping at night, but it's going to take a long time. You, of course, could get cable or DSL and then get up your machine. Or you can go ahead and buy one of these CDs. Or get a friend to burn the package for you. You could theoretically just download the service pack and burn it onto a CD. Sean actually did that for us. This application is actually from Microsoft. It's a free application. Anybody that has Microsoft Windows can have this Service Pack 10.2 application install. So if you can get someone else to make a copy of it for you that you can take to your home, that's the way to go about it. And if you don't have that kind of resources of a geek friend or somebody that can do that for you, and you have a slow internet connection, then your best bet is to go to Microsoft.com and get a CD version of this Service Pack 2. So that's, I think, our first step in getting a machine set up. In fact, there are such vulnerabilities in the operating system that have been in the past that without any patches, a clean install of XP can theoretically, if it's connected to the network, can get a virus or a worm right away. So it's kind of important to do this before you connect to the internet. And now, since it's an online update, it's a little strange, but if you do get the CD or a copy from somebody else, don't have your machine connected to the internet when you do this. Okay, so windowsupdate.microsoft.com is our first step. The second step is to have a virus protection software application on your computer. I personally use Norton Antivirus. Miles, what do you use for virus protection? Do you have anything?
AVG scan. Yeah.
And that's one we're going to recommend because it's free. John, you have Macintosh machines, so you don't need virus protection.
In the past, when I was director of technology for the school district, we used Sophos. We also have used McAfee.
But the
most effective one is one that has an automatic update and an automatic scan.
And Sophos and McAfee and Norton Antivirus, those are the big three names. All of them have the application. Most of these applications are free, and then there's a service that actually, to get your updates, you have to have the service enabled. And that has to do with the application being smart enough to do automatic updates of the protection software, and that's called spam definitions. Is that right, John? Spam definitions? That's what it's downloading?
For when you update your antivirus stuff?
Yeah.
It depends on who you're updating it for.
Each one has its own name for what it is.
Right.
So the one we're recommending, just because it's free and we're a whole completely volunteer group of geeks here doing the show, so we like free, AVG Antivirus. So you can get to that by going to the page and installing it. Now, who here has installed that? John, has anybody installed it? Well, Miles, you use AVG, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
AVG.
Yeah.
How is it? Is it any good?
It seems to work for me.
What about the virus definitions upgrading? Is it automatic, or do you have to manually do it?
No, it's automatic. You set the schedule for how often it looks for the virus definitions. I have it set up for every month, and it looks for just if there's new versions, it downloads it. And you can set up for how often it checks it. I originally had it check every evening, mm-hmm. basically at midnight.
Mm-hmm.
But
so you leave the machine on a lot.
Well, then I found that it conflicted with my actual browsing work schedule, because I was up at midnight and all right. of a sudden I'd be slowed down because I was checking my hard drive. But.
So I think the geek recommendation is this. If you are relatively geeky or you want to do some learning yourself, do use AVG Antivirus. It's a great application. It works real well. But it's a little geeky. You've got to know a little bit about what you're doing. If you're not, you just want to have this thing work, go to your local computer store and buy a shrink wrap package like Norton Antivirus or McAfee or something of that nature.
And if you want to get really informed, you can go up to Sophos.com and subscribe to their security newsletter that they do, their email newsletter. And every week you will get a who's who on the latest viruses that have come out. And it is intense, the amount of viruses that come out every week.
This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com.
This week on This American Life, Josh visits the mean girl he knew in elementary school, and she's still mean.
They look right at you and say, I know you're garbage. You know you're garbage. Why pretend? And you're going to come over to my house, which is the biggest house I've ever seen in my life. And you're going to say, you see this garbage? This is what a real man provides for me.
Some people never get over it. The allure of the mean friend.
You know, you come here and you tape me for your stupid friend's radio show, and then you get the hell out.
Hear This American Life Sunday morning at 10, right after Car Talk on KUSP.
The Resource Center for Nonviolence presents Dissent is Patriotic, a symposium featuring David Harris, Bretta Apothecary, and Nara Arakata at noon on Saturday, September 11th at the Del Mar Theater. Tickets are available at the Resource Center for Nonviolence and Bookshop Santa Cruz. For more information, call 423-0900. You're listening to Geek Speak. If you'd like to join our discussion, ask us questions or comments pertaining to our topic, which is antivirus stuff, spyware and adware, you're welcome to call us. You can call about any technical problem you may be having about your computer. The phone numbers, phone lines are open, 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You're welcome to send us email by going and filling out the contact form at geekspeak.org. Click on the Geeks, then click on Send a Message. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet services, including DSL, spam filters, PHP, MySQL, now with nationwide access. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The Geeks this morning, Miles Elam, John Tracy, and Sean Cleveland. We're standing by to take your calls and questions pertaining to technology, computing, viruses, anti-viruses, and adware, spamware, and the like, and anything pertaining to your computer. The phone number is, again, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. And, Sean, you found some prices for that CD for Microsoft for Service Pack 2.
Yeah,
how much is it?
It appears to be free. No charge.
That's the best.
How much for shipping?
No charge.
Wow, so Microsoft really wants to get this thing out there.
Yeah, it's going to be shipped via standard mail, mm-hmm. and they expect it will take 4 to 6 weeks to get here.
Wow.
So I ordered one, so...
We'll see how it works.
We'll see how long it takes. Yeah.
So definitely, if you do have a 28-speed modem or something to the equivalent, go to Microsoft.com, find this CD for Service Pack 2, and get it.
Now, it'll be faster to mail than it will be to download.
Just go to Microsoft.com, and the whole front page is dedicated to Service Pack 2.
Okay, now, that's for Windows XP users. If you're a Windows 98 person, then you got to go to WindowsUpdate.Microsoft.com and get the most recent patches on there. But luckily, you won't have to get many patches after that, because once you've done it, the operating system is pretty much not getting any more updates. And if they are getting updates, it's going to be small ones. So don't be too concerned about the download speed for that. Of course, Windows 98 has problems that you might want to upgrade your operating system. I don't know if you want to pay as much as Microsoft asks you to pay for it, but it is an older operating system. All right. On line one, Christina from SoCal. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. This is Christina. Anyways, I was wondering, I tried to download SP2 last Wednesday night, and some funny things happened. First of all, it wouldn't let me go offline to install it.
Mm-hmm. No, you can't go offline to install it.
Which, once it was downloaded, and I went to a coffee shop to download it because I knew it would take, like, hours and hours at home.
Yeah.
and a download of fine, but it wouldn't let me disconnect to install
it. When you did this, did you go to windowsupdate.microsoft.com and did it from there?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So the issue is that it's not really downloading the whole thing when you first do that download. It downloads the installer, and then it starts downloading as you need it.
And the problem was a number of things happened. First of all, it changed all the settings on my computer. It downloaded another data source object thing, which, always tries to get onto my computer. It's like a worm, I guess.
Microsoft's not installing a worm on your machine.
Oh, no, but I think it's something that's trying to get at my computer at every opportunity.
That sounds a little confusing to me. Basically, Microsoft is basically installing stuff on your machine that it thinks it's going to make your computing life a little easier and better.
And the thing was, after that, I could no longer do any login screen, like go to Hotmail or any of that thing.
You mean the password was, your username and password was erased?
No, it was way stranger than that. It would tell me that my browser would not accept cookies, even when I set it to accept cookies.
Did you have your browser on while the update happened?
It wouldn't turn. It wouldn't let me turn it off.
I'm sorry you had so much trouble with it. I would recommend that you get the CD from Microsoft and install it from there.
Right. I was wondering
is
there any way to get it to download into a file rather than to download directly onto your computer?
Yes.
How do you get it to download into a file?
You have to be part of the development network. But
what?
Sometimes Microsoft gives you that option. Let me look to see if they're doing that this time.
You can't. If you're part of a development network, there's some groups that allow the downloading of that. And you have to be...
I'm just a home version XP.
Sean is looking that up, and we'll answer it on air. Christina, thank you very much for the call.
Yeah, can I ask one more question?
Quickly.
What would cause... you think my browser was damaged? See, I restored everything back to an earlier time before this all happened.
How did you do that, restore?
Using XP restore.
Okay.
Saying to an earlier date.
Uh-huh.
And that basically also got rid of that whatever it was that got aboard.
And what's your question?
And that got aboard, of course, the moment I turned off the cookies on my browser, the cookie refusal on my browser to see, to see if I could check my Hotmail afterwards. My question is what is a data source object exploit? That's a message I keep on getting.
Source object exploit.
And it's something that I've had removed out of my register before, and whether restoring it seems to have removed it, but...
It's what you're describing is a very wide umbrella term for something.
Something's broken.
Well, what it means, a data source exploit, data source just means any place where you keep data.
Right.
So...
It's some sort of program that tries to get to data to me, which sounds to me like a worm.
No, not necessarily. It could be part of your operating system. It's not necessarily a worm just because it's
Chinese. I could even see someone applying that term to just a cookie. There's just some data in a cookie.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily a tremendously bad thing. It's not.
Do this. To get next time you're at the coffee shop, go install Mozilla's Thunderbird email client. And
I tried to find it back.
Excuse me, just a second. And install Firefox. And when you go to your Hotmail account, use Firefox. And Firefox is not allowing cookies to be saved?
Well, not yet, but that's...
Okay, so I recommend using that.
I had Firefox before. Unfortunately, I've had to go through so much restoring and stuff. I lost a lot of stuff also when my computer crashed not long ago.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't installed it yet. I just got it last Wednesday, too, when I had the Zippy internet connection. Mozilla...
Uh-huh.
Email client. Is that like Thunderbird? I couldn't find
Thunderbird.
We're
going to be talking about that in just a second, so you can go ahead and listen to the show.
But yes,
Is that similar?
Yes. Christina, thank you very much for the call.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
And a note for folks that are out there with Firefox and Mozilla Mail, I think some other browsers may do this too, but not IE, mm-hmm. is that you're able to, for example, turn off all cookies, but then if you come across a site that you have to have cookies that you then you're okay with using, like, for example, if you have a Hotmail account and you want to check your email and need that, you can enable cookies on a site-by-site basis. to be able to
how
say
do you
all
do that in like in Firefox?
Firefox, you go into preferences, and then there's a privacy grouping. You click on the privacy tab, and it
you enter in the URLs that you like to accept cookies from.
Right.
Okay. Like Hotmail.com.
Exactly.
All right. Let's go down a little bit more through this list of recommendations. After you get your antivirus handled, the next thing to do is to get rid of spyware and adware. And basically, spyware and adware are slightly malicious applications that are installed on your machine. They're not necessarily, I mean, the spyware is definitely malicious, but the adware, the basic idea is that as you install one thing on your machine, other things that you don't really want are installed as well. And this can happen through ActiveS using Internet Explorer. It can happen by just downloading a good application that you want, a free application that you want, has this as kind of like an another package. And the reason why it's called adware is as you use the application, it looks at what you're doing and it throws up ads and new pop-up advertisements. If you don't have your browser open and you're going around doing stuff in like Word or something, and all of a sudden a pop-up happens that has content like an advertisement, you probably have adware installed on your machine. Now, Miles, you have an interesting story about a roommate.
Yes, my housemate Sebastian ended up with adware, a whole bunch of stuff on his system.
Is this adware or spyware?
Because
adware is something you voluntarily put in your computer.
Not necessarily.
Usually if you sign up to like a peer-to-peer file sharing network, something like that, right. It'll say, during the ActiveX install,
right.
It'll say we're installing this.
But sometimes the reason why he knew that he had something on his system was that a random Internet Explorer window would pop up on his system to show up, to say like, go to this place. So it was adware, but no, he didn't.
He wasn't aware
consciously
that he
put it on there.
He wasn't consciously aware that he put it on there.
Yeah,
he might have said yes to a user agreement that actually had that in the user agreement. So
or just said yes to an ActiveX control because.
So the safe thing to do, and this is what we recommend, is going ahead and getting a thing that removes adware and spyware. Now spyware is kind of like the adware, but instead of launching advertisements in front of you, it records what you're doing and then sells that information or gives that information to other people.
Right.
It can be used as a virus kind of worm thing as well. And what we recommend is Spybot Search and Destroy. You can get rid of any spyware and adware from your machine by downloading and installing Spybot Search and Destroy. It's a free application. Go to geekspeak.org, click on today's show, and you will see the link for that. It's item number 3 in steps to better computing. Number 4 and number 5 have to do with getting rid of the default Microsoft email and browser that's installed in your machine. Sean, you have a question?
Yeah, I found out how to find Microsoft Service Pack 2.
Okay.
As a download the whole thing and not go through the update.
Which is what you want to do if you have a slow connection, you have a friend with a fast connection and a CD burner. You download this entire thing, you burn it to a CD, and you bring it to your house.
Now, Microsoft offers this for IT professionals and developers because they're going to be installing it on multiple machines.
Right.
So we just had to find that. The way to do it is go to Microsoft.com/downloads. And that will put you at the download center. At the very top, you'll see the 5 most popular downloads. Number 2 is Windows XP Service Pack 2 for IT professionals and developers.
And that's what you want.
When you click on that, it'll take you to a page where you can download the whole thing, and then you can install it online or offline as you see fit.
At your leisure. All right, so that's the way to go. And again, it's Microsoft.com/downloads.
Yeah, Microsoft.com/downloads.
And luckily right now the most popular one, which is an easy link to find,
number 2,
is that.
We'll try and link to it. It's got some characters in the URL that may not work on our website.
We'll be able to link to it. If you want to, Sean, you want to
email
it to me.
Yeah, we'll put that link up on the website here shortly.
Now,
our website, geekspeak.org.
Yeah. So that's a recommendation on getting that service pack so that you don't have to deal with that being connected as you install kind of thing. We're going to go back to calls because they're waiting for us. Gene from Pacific Grove, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello?
Hello, is this Gene?
Yes, it is.
Welcome to GeekSpeak.
2 quick questions here. First, about service packs. I have Windows ME. Is that better than 98?
No.
It came out after 98.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it was better.
Okay. Should I get the service pack?
The service pack won't work for ME.
Okay, good.
So you don't have to.
Second question. I have never had a virus, knock on my head. but when my computer crashes and I turn it off and I start it up again, it says update Norton antivirus now. I always say no, notify me in 24 hours. Is that still active? And if I said yeah, go ahead, would it do it?
Yeah, probably. But it might ask you to pay for something.
That was my second question. Yeah. Probably because it hadn't heard from me in years. Well, I've been safe so far, so knock on wood, huh?
Yeah. Well, I would highly recommend either you can uninstall Norton Antivirus and go get this one that we're recommending that's AVG Antivirus. And when you do that, do have it update all the time. Eventually, you'll probably get a virus. You might actually have a virus and not even know it. Some of them are passive and do other things to your machine and slow them down and that nature. But don't actually do anything that tells you there's a virus.
Oh, okay.
So since you have Norton Antivirus already installed, I'd go ahead and open that application and have it do a run. It might say, well, you need to buy something. Mm-hmm. It's not that expensive. It's maybe for the ease of use for you, it makes sense to go ahead and pay for that. But I would definitely recommend having virus protection software running.
Okay, thank you a lot.
You bet.
Bye.
It's like backing up your hard drive. Yeah, my hard drive hasn't crashed yet.
Right.
So
it will eventually, though. All right. From Seaside, Amber, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello there.
Hello.
Hi. Can you explain to me or tell me what POP3 means? I am a novice, and I keep getting this message, quote, the host POP3 could not be found. Please verify that you have entered the server name correctly.
Are you able to get your email?
Well, I get my email through Yahoo. I just started trying to use the Outlook Express.
Okay.
And this is where I'm getting this message when I try to use Outlook.
But you don't actually get your email in Outlook?
No.
Okay. So what's happening basically is your Outlook settings are not set up correctly to connect to your POP server. And a POP, or POP server, the more complete name for it is POP3. It's
Post Office Protocol Version 3.
Uh-huh.
And basically it's the way you get email. There's a server out there that holds your email as it comes in from the internet, and you use POP3 protocol or POP3 to access that box and download your message to your machine.
How do I do that?
Well, who's your ISP? Where's your email?
Well, I'm using AOL as my ISP.
Okay. So AOL does not have POP3 support. It has its own, you have to use its own application. And Yahoo, I think is what you said, is for the web mail?
I go to AOL, and then I go and, access Yahoo and get my email.
And Yahoo, unless you get a paid Yahoo, doesn't have POP3. So you don't want to have Outlook running. Basically, AOL has its proprietary way of reading email, and Yahoo has a web interface for getting email. So uninstall, disactivate Outlook. Don't use it.
Don't use it. Okay, one more quick question, please.
Mm-hmm.
I have a Hewlett-Packard PSC2110 all-in-one scanner, printer,
uh-huh.
I think. And I got a program with that where they have a HP share to web, share your pictures to the web.
Right.
And when I try to share my pictures to the web, I can't seem to get in. And I was wondering if you could give me any help there.
They're giving you some kind of online service. And what you're going to need to do is make sure that you have the username and password for that online service. That's a little difficult because I'm not familiar. Geeks, are anybody familiar with the HP service called?
Yeah, each one is going to be different.
Web share?
There's no common way to...
Oh, you know, it's possible that the share to web, when it says share to web, it's just a default application that's supposed to connect to some web share.
I see.
That's probably an FTP or a web dav, and that's a service that your ISP would give you. AOL has web space, but since you're using AOL, you don't really have the features.
Can you translate what you just said?
Sure. There are different ways to put content onto servers, web servers, and you have to get content onto web servers to have them accessible on the web. So your internet service provider, in your case AOL, but internet service providers will give you web space, and that's like personal web space. It normally comes in different sizes. And you use an application like your share to web application that comes with your scanner to connect to that system and put new content on it. But if your ISP doesn't give you what you need to have that application connect, then you can't share it. So you have to find some internet service provider that will give you web space, and you have to set up your application to connect to that web space. AOL does have web space. I know that you can connect and do stuff that way. I don't know the settings for it. But
it would probably be tricky to do it through the scanner web sharing.
Yeah, it might be tricky. What you want to do is go to AOL, since it's your person that would be the company that would be providing the service for you, and do searches for personal web space, AOL homepages or personal homepages, and you'll get to a place that talks about how you have a website that you can have on AOL. And in that, it should talk about the settings you need to connect these things. But I'd recommend getting a geek to come visit with you.
Pardon me?
I'd recommend getting a geek to come visit with you, unless you want to dive into the world of publishing, publishing. Yeah.
So you are suggesting that I first just disable Outlook, and I guess I do that through the uninstall?
Yeah, you could uninstall Outlook. That'd be fine.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
All right, thank you very much, Amber. Well, we're shortly running out of time. We have two more calls we're going to take. But let me just address the two last things. And Amber got it perfectly. We don't like using Outlook or Outlook Express. And the reason for that is traditionally it has kind of default, it defaultly runs viruses that get emailed to you. And the easiest and most common way for a virus to get on a machine is having it being emailed to you from someone else's infected machine, and then you double-click on it. We say all the time, don't open an attachment, blah, blah, blah. But in the past, Outlook and Outlook Express actually ran those automatically sometimes, depending on the extension. Those have been fixed to some degree, but new problems emerge with the Outlook family of email clients. So we just say don't use them. Use a free one that's better and easier, and the one that we recommend is Thunderbird. And you can get to Thunderbird by going to mozilla.org and downloading Thunderbird, and it's available for all operating systems.
Although Outlook's become better, just so we give a nice visual for folks out there as to get them to switch, think of walking down Times Square, someone hands you a hypodermic needle, and then you stick it into your neck. You hope that nothing happens.
Right.
That's using Outlook on the net.
That's a little harsh.
So, makes you think, huh?
The other thing is Internet Explorer. We talked about, during the show today, we talked about how Internet Explorer is great for updating your operating system because it runs applications called ActiveX applications very easily. Unfortunately, because of the ease of running, you can accidentally run something like a virus or spamware. Adware and that like. So we recommend not using Internet Explorer as your default web server, browser. And we recommend Firefox, which again is by Mozilla. And at mozilla.org, you can find Firefox, it's a web browser, and Thunderbird, which is the email client. We highly recommend those. We're going to try to get one more call in here. Peter from Santa Cruz, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hello.
Do you think it's all right if I can give a warning about a product that's available as shareware?
It's your call. Go for it.
Yeah, it's Grokster, and it's best that everyone be alerted. I downloaded Grokster, and installed it, and it released keyloggers, viruses, Trojans. I couldn't believe it's Pandora's box.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very, very dangerous program. This is kind of backed up by comments that people made at the download.com.
Could you spell that? What's the
Can you spell this bad?
Grokster. It's a file sharing.
Grokster.
Yeah, it's like SpeedStream. It's a music file sharing. It was involved in a court case where the prosecution couldn't make its case against Grokster because file sharing is okay, and the people can't get.
Can you spell it one more time for us?
Grokster, Grok, S T E R.
Okay, so Grokster is actually a type of sharing technology, isn't that right, Miles?
Technology, yeah. And if you download
well, among
the program,
other things, but
The thing that's kind of confusing here is that Grokster is actually it's kind of a way of sharing files, and there are certain applications that could use that. And you download an application that used that happened to have really bad stuff going on with it. But there are probably good applications that use that technology as well.
Oh, of course.
So you're kind of like saying, don't use a web browser because I had one that installed that thing. So we just want to clear that up.
Yeah, Grokster itself, the file that I downloaded from the main site, Grokster's main site, that had all these things.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, we'll investigate it. Miles looks very concerned about this. So.
Okay, now your subject was going to be good programs for spy bots. Can I mention a few?
I use these.
I was covered by AVG too. I love AVG. It's a remarkable.
And that's the virus protection.
I love it. Yeah. And I have Adaware and Spybot Search and Destroy. But when these things got released into my system, I needed more. And so what helped a lot was Hijack This and CW Shredder.
Hijack This and CW Shredder. Okay.
Yeah. And B-H-O Demon.
B-H-O Demon.
And each of those played a part in helping get rid of all these horrible things.
Okay. Did you try Spybot Search and Destroy?
Oh, I've used that for years.
Okay, well, so you use more instead on top of that.
Which one?
You use those other applications
On top
well.
Of them. Everything got along fine.
See, there's one thing that's concerned about the recommendations on all these different things to use, is that sometimes these things that you search for and try to find that will clean up your machine install
dangerous.
More stuff on there.
Very dangerous.
Yeah.
I
so
know.
We're trying to keep to it kind of simple and clean and keep
well,
it only a few things as recommendations.
But don't, if you download Grokster and install it, things will get complex real fast.
Right. Well, thank you very much for the call.
Yeah. BHO Demon is a wonderful one, though, too, also.
BHO
helped me a lot.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call.
Okay.
All right. Bye, Peter. Well, we did get a call off air. Why do graphic artists prefer CRT screens versus flat screens? And flat screens, when we talk about flat screens, what we mean is flat panels, because flat screens are kind of hard to determine if it's a CRT or a flat panel. But why use a CRT, which is like a traditional TV, which has a tube, a cathode ray tube, versus an LCD, which is a liquid crystal display, which is those flat ones? And the reason is there's more color in CRTs. Would you agree with that, Sean?
I think that's it. Yeah,
higher
yeah.
temperature range.
Higher yeah. temperature range.
Your so blacks are true black.
Yep. So there's different. There's better color, basically, on
and you
a CRT.
You can color match with a CRT.
Better color matching. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So that's the answer to why those are. Now, in everyday things, color matching might not be such an issue. It's hard to even tell the millions of colors that a CRT, the LCD can display. So it depends on how specific you are about the colors you want to look on your machine. When it comes down to it, a computer screen or what it is, no matter what it is, won't do the richness of the
right.
real world.
If you have a Pantone color wheel, you need a CRT. If you don't know what a Pantone color wheel is, you're fine with it.
Yeah.
That's good.
Really, you need to be a graphic professional.
To
you know,
get it.
Someone yeah. who works closely with a printer to really require, to need a CRT.
Yep. And a high-end printer, when we're talking.
Yeah, we're talking high-end printer. Someone you send a print job off to, and they all right. write thousands, millions, whatever.
So, again, you want to go to geekspeak.org, click on today's show, which is Combating Adware, Spyware, and Internet Scams. Go through those five steps to better computing if you're on a Windows machine. At least that's our recommendation. Grey Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Grey Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. The Geeks Today were Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland, and John Tracy. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Thank you all for participating in GeekSpeak today.
Always a blast.
Yep. Thank you, Lyle.
To those of you that called in, thank you for making GeekSpeak what it is. We appreciate your support. We'll be back next week, as we are every week, 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KDBH, San Ardo, or on the web at kusp.org. Coming up next is Open Road, and at 1 p.m., Two Steps in the Blues with Charlie Lang. For KUSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Bush has signed executive orders to reform the U.S. intelligence community. White House aides say the orders will strengthen the powers of the CIA director and establish a national counterterrorism center. NPR's Mary Louise Kelly has more.
The president's plan is to give the CIA director, for now, some of the authority envisioned by the 9/11 Commission. That panel called for the creation of a powerful intelligence chief. But Congress is deeply divided.